Today is Tuesday, November 26th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the president defends his efforts to shield a U.S. Navy SEAL from punishment.
I think what I'm doing is sticking up for our armed forces, and there's never been a president that's going to stick up for them and has like I have.
A setback for the Trump administration's efforts to keep a former top aide from testifying in the impeachment inquiry. Also ahead, next month's Billboard Music Awards will bring more validation to two of Sunday's big American Music Award winners. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, the witnesses have spoken, the politics largely settled, and now the impeachment investigators need to make the case for public opinion. On Monday, hundreds of pages from Democratic Chairman Adam Schiff's Intelligence Committee were compiled or being compiled into a report that will begin to outline whether President Donald Trump engaged in, quote, treason, bribery, or high crimes and misdemeanors by withholding $400 million in aid as he pushed Ukraine to investigate Democratic rival Joe Biden. Trump, during a meeting with Bulgaria's president at the White House, defended his personal attorney Rudy Giuliani, whose name has been repeatedly mentioned in connection with Ukraine during the hearings.
Rudy's a great person, and I think that maybe the press isn't treating Rudy very well, and I think that's unfair. But Rudy was a great mayor and a great crime fighter.
Also Monday, a federal judge dealt a setback to President Trump's effort to keep top aides from testifying before Congress. AP correspondent Ben Thomas reports.
Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson has ordered former White House counsel Don McGahn to comply with a subpoena and appear before the House Judiciary Committee. McGahn was a star witness in special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election. The Judiciary Committee's lawsuit challenges the White House rationale that McGahn and other witnesses have absolute immunity from testifying. The outcome could lead to renewed efforts by House Democrats to compel testimony in the impeachment inquiry from other high-ranking administration officials, including former National Security Advisor John Bolton. An appeal of the judge's ruling is expected. Ben Thomas, Washington.
Well, there are rising political stakes for all sides. Americans remain deeply split over the impeachment question, despite hours of sometimes riveting testimony. And the country's polarization now seems to foreshadow an outcome. Democrats are poised to vote to impeach the president, while Republicans stand firmly with Trump. Still, it is a process that could, with support, end a president's removal. Impeachment hearings are just the start of what's prescribed by the U.S. Constitution. VOA's Steve Reddish has an overview of what's taking place.
Impeachment. The word has been around since mid-16th century England. It means to challenge credibility or validity. Impeachment is mentioned six times in the U.S. Constitution, but the document does not specify how it is to be carried out. Article 1 of the Constitution gives the House of Representatives, the lower but larger of the two chambers of Congress, the sole power of impeachment. The House investigates and then drafts articles of impeachment. A simple majority vote of the now 435 members is required to impeach. Impeachment does not automatically mean removal from office. Once the House approves articles of impeachment, the upper chamber of Congress, the Senate, holds a trial. From the U.S. Supreme Court, the Chief Justice of the United States presides over that trial. Two-thirds of the 100 senators are needed to vote to convict and remove from office.
Removing the President of the United States before an election is a drastic thing. And the Constitution does not want it to happen often. So they put in a very high bar, the two-thirds, 67, and yes, it would have to be both parties.
Article 2 of the Constitution sets out the criteria and punishment. Removal from office on impeachment and conviction for treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. 14 U.S. judges and one justice have been impeached. 9 were convicted and removed. 4 U.S. presidents have faced an impeachment inquiry by the House. 2 were impeached, none were convicted. Andrew Johnson was impeached in 1868 for firing the Secretary of War over the objections of the Senate amid repeated clashes over civil rights for newly freed African-American slaves. More than 100 years after Johnson's impeachment in 1974, Richard Nixon resigned before an impeachment vote could take place in connection with a break-in at Democratic Party headquarters and the subsequent cover-up of the crime. Bill Clinton was impeached in 1998 for lying under oath about a sexual affair with an intern. And now Donald Trump is facing an impeachment inquiry in the Democratic-controlled House for soliciting a foreign government to investigate a political rival. Impeachment hearings are underway, with a vote likely before the end of the year. Steve Reddish, VOA News.
Well, President Trump is defending his intervention in the demotion of a Navy SEAL accused of battlefield misconduct and the two pardons he granted to service personnel earlier this month. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn has that.
In the high-profile case of Chief Petty Officer Edward Gallagher,
I wanted to take his pin away, and I said, no, you're not going to take it away. He was a great fighter.
President Trump had Gallagher's rank reinstated to preserve his pension, and according to Defense Secretary Mark Esper, ordered that a disciplinary review be stopped.
Somebody has their back, and it's called the President of the U.S., okay?
The intervention, though, raises questions about America's commitment to international standards for battlefield ethics. The Pentagon says the president has a constitutional right to intervene, but one retired Navy admiral says he's concerned this will have a chilling effect on Special Forces' willingness to report illegal behavior. Jackie Quinn, Washington.
Here are some of the stories we're following at VOAnews.com. Ankara is defying Washington over Russian missiles. Denmark repatriates an 11-month-old boy reportedly orphaned in Syria. The UN says sexual violence affects one in three women globally. And it's a royal mess as Britain's monarchy faces its biggest crisis since the 1990s. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Hong Kong's leader says she respects the results of local elections in which pro-democracy forces scored a sweeping victory and said she would reflect on them seriously. During Sunday's elections, opposition candidates won nearly 90% of contested seats, according to public broadcaster RTHK. The Democrats will now control 17 of 18 district councils after having previously controlled zero. Democratic Party Chairman Wu Chi-wai.
We have a landslide victory coming from all the peoples of Hong Kong. And as a result, altogether, we get more than 250 seats in the elections.
VOA Asia's Ira Melman talked about it with Timothy Cheek, director of the Institute of Asian Research at the University of British Columbia, about the stunning Hong Kong election results. And he asks Cheek if he was surprised.
I was happily surprised, both by the turnout, the peacefulness, and by the likely results that, you know, strong support for candidates associated with the demonstrations or democracy or democratic leaning. It was the only good news we've had out of Hong Kong in quite a while.
Is there any way whatsoever that the results of the election and those elected who are part of the democracy movement and the protesters will have a valid say in the government?
Only in a limited way. But what's important is that I think what has been driving the ongoing demonstrations and even some of the turn towards violence is the utter frustration, desperation, and despair that young people feel in Hong Kong, that they just don't have a voice, that Beijing just doesn't care, and that nothing they can do within the system is going to make any difference. That they turned around and supported these elections with a very high turnout, what I think 71% versus 48% last time, and got a pretty good hit in terms of getting people they wanted elected, I can only hope will be a positive sign that it's worth trying to find a way to work through some organizational way as opposed to on the street to address these ongoing and real concerns that the people of Hong Kong have.
So what do you think is going to happen? Will there be renewed protest or not?
The honest answer is I don't know. I suspect there will be, but what I'll be looking for is the intensity, size, and the amount of violence. It's still perfectly legitimate to remind the government, a government that has not been responsive, that their issues have not been addressed. But even this small incremental ability to express their voice and have it recognized. Now, if the Beijing government turns around and throws out some of the elected Democratic candidates or otherwise is sort of unilateral and hard-handed, all hell will break loose.
And what's the possibility of that? Do you have any inside information? And if not, just give me how you feel about it.
Boy, I wish I had inside information and the information was good. What I do have is, I'll call it a slightly higher grader gossip amongst the scholars. And there is a feeling that you call them factions or divisions or sections within the government in Beijing, but it is clear, particularly by the restraint that the Beijing government showed around National Day, October 1, that there are voices in the Chinese government that says you cannot go to the wall on this, that they want to find a solution that is something short of another Tiananmen. Whether they will prevail or whether hotheads or hardliners will prevail, we just don't know. It's really, really anxiety provoking.
It is really a toss-up, is it not? No one really does know, except maybe those who are going to make the decision, and there are chances they don't know yet either, right?
Exactly, because the Hong Kong protests are almost unprecedented in that they are a truly social movement without leaders. This is the frustration of an entire society. When you have 1 million, 2 million people on the streets, you know, that is just, you know, there's always a Beijing speaker that says, oh, the CIA is funding this. And one of my colleagues responded and said, well, thank you for the compliment. CIA is almost never this successful. And, you know, it's a joke. This is a social movement from the Hong Kong people. And that's a powerful and wonderful thing to see. But the downside is there's no leaders to negotiate with. And that's what we need to have now. There needs to be a climb down and a way to negotiate to get these problems addressed. And because as long as the government continues to stonewall, there will be demonstrations.
Beijing has already voiced its support for Carrie Lam. What do you think is going to happen as far as she is concerned?
Well, you know, there's never been a chief executive that's done well, because the system under one country, two systems, and the way that Beijing wants to run it, you know, are at odds. And so Carrie Lam's already made it clear she'd like to step down. And of course, Beijing won't let her. The current gossip among scholars is that they will let her step down after the two meetings in March of the National People's Congress and the Consultative Congress. But they want a decent interval after street demonstrations stop.
Do you expect any movement, a possible movement from China to have a greater sense of democracy?
Ultimately, no. But I do think that the Communist Party has in the past, from time to time, been very pragmatic. And if pragmatic voices will go, they will offer some short-term solution, some short-term ability. In China, the Communist Party government has allowed certain kinds of local democracies around the country from time to time, as long as it doesn't challenge their rule. The problem is that the hardline tactics of the past 6 months have alienated the young people. They might have been willing to try some compromise, consultative, something or other 6 months ago. But the problem now is what the party is likely to offer and what it has historically offered in broadly comparable situations is not enough. I am deeply worried about what's going to happen.
All right. That's Timothy Cheek. He's director of the Institute of Asian Research at the University of British Columbia, speaking with VOA Asia's Ira Melman. Well, during the Rwandan genocide in 1994, some 800,000 people, primarily ethnic Tutsis, died at the hand of ethnic Hutus. Blood flowed throughout the Central African country, though less so in one remote northern town. VOA's Edward Rumima reports.
Before the Rwandan genocide, the town of Giti, according to its mayor at the time, was special.
What made Giti unique at the time is the way we lived in harmony, regardless of our ethnicity. We used to give each other gifts of cows, and we intermarried. There was no division among us.
Edward Sebushumba was the mayor of Giti, a small lakeside community in northern Rwanda, when the 100-day killing spree broke out in April 1994. Radio announcements called for avenging the death of President Juvenal Habyarimana, an ethnic Hutu whose plan was shot down that April 6. They urged hunting down and killing ethnic Tutsis. Sebushumba, a Hutu, instead vowed to protect them. He was able to do so at least for the first 2 weeks before Tutsi defenders arrived to help.
None of our community leaders slept. We would do night patrols to ensure that nobody was hurt and nobody tried to start violence.
Sebushumba, now 69, was determined to protect the thousands of Tutsis in Giti, he said of the violence.
In most cases, they do it because the leadership supported those acts of evil. We took a stand and made sure our people understood that we did not support the killings.
Townspeople had to fend off attackers from neighboring communities, including militias who tried to cross Lake Muhazi to come and kill.
I ordered our residents to camp near the lake to make sure they didn't cross over. We used stones and other traditional weapons to overpower them.
Only Tutsis fleeing other communities were allowed into Giti. Sebushumba asked boat owners to bring them across the lake to safety. Alphonse Nizeimana, then an 18-year-old Hutu, operated a boat.
I personally saved close to 30 people. We would do rescues at night to avoid being seen by attackers.
But the town did not escape violence. Naftal Ahishakie, executive secretary of Ibuka, the Association of Genocide Survivors, told The Voice of America he cannot categorically state there was no genocide in Giti. However, the level of involvement by Giti residents was very low compared to the rest of the country. Sebushumba acknowledges some deaths.
There were no people killed under my watch in Giti. However, we lost some Giti natives who lived in other parts of the country. Many were killed because they came from Giti.
There have been questions about whether the mayor's role was mythologized as part of the government's push for reconciliation. Emmanuel Rubangura, a Tutsi who is now 59, sees no exaggeration. He says he is alive because of Sebushumba's bravery.
Our mayor took a lead in urging people not to kill their neighbors.
Sebushumba praised Giti's townspeople for fighting evil. Embracing humanity, he says, is helping Rwanda heal wounds from 25 years ago. Edward Rema, VOA News, Giti, in northern Rwanda.
And you're listening to International Edition, back in a minute.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcast. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, it's a big week in U.S. movie theaters as the holiday season officially begins. Joining us to talk more about some of the most anticipated films is Vegas film critic Jeffrey K. Howard. Jeff, a beautiful day in the neighborhood about the children's TV host known as Mr. Rogers looks like it could be a big hit.
It's a beautiful day in this neighborhood, a beautiful day.
I read an article recently that he was sort of considered like the toddler televangelist.
That's a good description. I'm Generation X, so I was about 4 or 5 when Mr. Rogers appeared, and I was one of those kids that when Mr. Rogers started, I took my dad's cardigan out of the closet when he came on television. I changed my shoes into my dad's shoes. I mean, I did all of that, and I still remember every one of the songs. And a couple years ago, we had Won't You Be My Neighbor, which was a documentary about the legacy of Mr. Rogers. It's a Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood with Tom Hanks is not a Mr. Rogers biopic at all. In fact, it's surprising a lot of people.
Really?
It's based on the 1998 Escape Esquire magazine article by Tom Junow. And he met Mr. Rogers to do a hero piece for Esquire magazine, only about 400 words. When he takes on an assignment to profile Mr. Rogers, he begins this friendship, this real-life friendship between the journalist and Mr. Rogers. And Tom Junow is going through a real difficult time with his father. In the movie, we find out that he has got this long history with his father, real turmoil with his marriage. He's got a newborn baby. But Mr. Rogers is like, you know, taking his picture and saying, well, what's wrong? He offers his friendship and counseling. It is a real touching movie. And yes, they do shoot the show. You know, there's parts of the show that we see in the movie, but they bookend. The director bookends the movie like a Mr. Rogers episode. So at the beginning of the movie, Tom Hanks walks in as Mr. Rogers, shows you this little advent calendar kind of thing and says, this is Lloyd. He's my friend and he's going through some trouble. And then we go through the whole movie and then we bookend it at the end where he says goodbye like an episode. And Tom Hanks is in it just enough. He's not in it the whole movie, but he's in it enough because, again, it's more about the relationship between the journalist and Mr. Rogers. Yeah, and I bawled my eyes out at the end. It's really a heartwarming film. It's a dramatic film. It's definitely adult themed, so it's not for children or family. Okay. But it's one of my favorite films of the year, absolutely. And Hanks is phenomenal.
Wow. And this one has been, at least I know, everyone with kids just could not wait for Frozen 2 to come out.
Far away, as north as we can go, once stood an enchanted forest.
And it's finally here.
It is finally here. After a couple of years, one of Disney's most successful animated features. Who doesn't know Let It Go and who doesn't? I must have watched the original Frozen 5 or 6 times, and it's wonderful. It really is. So now we're back. We have Elsa the Snow Queen and her sister Anna. They embark on a new adventure of this kingdom named Adrenaline. And they're joined by their friends from the first movie, you know, Kristoff, Olin, and Sven. It's not a slam dunk. I have a lot of problems with Frozen 2. But I want to start off by saying, Lori, this is a critic-proof movie. It doesn't matter what I think of the movie. Families are going to go see it. It's already setting records for opening weekend. But the movie's confusing because it's got this geopolitical kind of plot going on between the kingdoms that's not interesting. It's got about 10 songs that are all Broadway style. And there are these abstract music videos, which get so tedious after a while. And here's my biggest complaint. Disney has taken this girl power to its nauseating apex because now the men are ridiculed in the entire film, okay? Kristoff, who keeps trying to propose to Anna the whole movie, he tries to propose 3 or 4 times as a bumbling fool. He doesn't get to help with the adventure. He doesn't get to throw his 2 cents. He's regulated to being a bumbling idiot. And that just really upset me that, you know, the whole movie, the men are treated like second-class citizens. I just thought, at least they're equals. Give them something. And not only that, Olaf is the only saving grace in this movie, voiced by Josh Gad. That was the only fun in the movie is when Olaf was on screen cracking me up or singing one of his memorable songs. But overall, I just hated Frozen 2. But
wow.
Like I said, yeah, I know. The only reason it didn't get an F is because of Olaf. Mm-hmm. I thought there was too many problems. He couldn't whistle any of the songs coming out of the movie. There's these complex, Broadway, plot-driven songs that just was overkill, and I kept thinking, kids are going
to
hate it.
I guess we'll find out how the kids feel as opposed to you, the big kid.
But it's making a fortune, so it doesn't matter what I think.
Exactly. And then we've got a one coming out on Thanksgiving.
You know something. Spill it.
I suspect foul play.
Knives Out? What's that about?
Knives Out. This is from director Rian Johnson. And like him, I grew up reading Agatha Christie. I read Sherlock Holmes. Movies growing up, I loved Murder on the Orient Express or Death on the Nile, Evil Under the Sun, or all the Miss Marple movies that came out in the 1960s. This is a return to that. This is a return to a murder mystery starring Christopher Plummer, who dies during his 85th birthday celebration with his family surrounding him. And of course, the family all want his millions. He's a successful Broadway whodunit author. So listen to this cast. I mean, this is an unbelievable cast, and each one of them has their own unique character. Chris Evans is a lot more than Captain America. Daniel Craig is one of the investigators. We got Toni Collette, Jamie Lee Curtis, Michael Shannon, Don Johnson. It's almost like watching a play with all these family members, all with their knives out, wanting the inheritance that went to their father's medical assistant. Can you believe that? In the very final days, he changed his will. So now the family's like, what's going on here? So, of course, there's lots of twists in this movie. There's lots of whodunit ending that I can't spoil for you. But if you want to see a great old-fashioned whodunit movie with a little bit of comedy and a little bit of suspense, got to check out Knives Out. It was a good time.
All right. Knives Out in, Frozen Out.
That's about it, yes.
Well, all right.
You left me cold.
All right. Oh, very good. Jeffrey K. Howard, you can find his full video reviews at VegasFilmCritic.com. Jeff, thanks so much. We'll talk to you soon.
My pleasure. Happy Thanksgiving.
Well, after an astounding night Sunday at the American Music Awards, Taylor Swift and Billie Eilish are about to receive even more validation. 17-year-old Eilish will be presented with the 2019 Billboard Woman of the Year at next month's Women in Music event. And Taylor Swift will also be honored at the event. She will receive the inaugural honor of Woman of the Decade. Now, on Sunday night, Swift moonwalked past Michael Jackson's record at the 2019 American Music Awards, taking home 6 honors, including Artist of the Year and Artist of the Decade. Eilish picked up 2 awards, including New Artist of the Year and Favorite Alternative Artist. I'm that bad type, make your mama sad type, make your girlfriend mad type, might seduce your dad type. I'm the bad guy. You have been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you for listening and thank you for joining us. And of course, we thank our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day. But you're taking shots at me like it's Patron, and I'm just like, damn, it's 7 a.m. Say it in the street, that's a knockout. But just say it in a tweet, that's a cop-out. And I'm just like, hey, are you okay? And I ain't trying to mess with your self-expression, but I've learned a lesson that stressing and obsessing about somebody else is no fun. And snakes and stones never broke my bones, so
next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In late October, USAID and its partners, including Grand Challenges Canada, Australian Aid, the United Kingdom's Department for International Development, and other donor organizations, announced the Million Lives Club. This multi-donor initiative plans to create a global community of innovators and organizations, each of whom is improving the lives of more than 1 million people living on less than $5 a day. The Million Lives Club will help members scale up operations by attracting the funding and support they need. Scaling up means taking successful projects, programs, or policies and expanding, adapting, and sustaining them for greater development impact. In doing so, the Million Lives Club hopes to debunk the persistent myth that nothing is scaling and that there is nothing available in which donors can invest, said Alexis Bunnell, USAID's Chief Innovation Officer. The Million Lives Club is uniquely positioned to disprove this myth and to offer support to its members because it has attracted the attention of many donors and funders, said Ms. Bunnell. One of the goals, she said, is to achieve a roster of organizations that are having exceptionally prolific social impact.
If you're talking about the journey to self-reliance or people being able to move away from poverty to not require foreign aid anymore, at some point they have to be able to take control of their own destiny. And that means they have to start exercising preference or choice. So what I love about the Million Lives Club is that in the journey to self-reliance, these social entrepreneurs are really empowering their customers. They're not making them beneficiaries. They're really empowering choice and options. What's exciting is that when you start getting to a million customers, we know that you're really providing value.
Announcing the Million Lives Club was just a baby step in getting to the process of this learning journey, said Alexis Bunnell. I think that what we really hope is that other investors, other funders, and most importantly, other players in the ecosystem will also get excited about these organizations that are scaling. The Million Lives Club hopes to double its list of members in the coming year and plans to announce new cohorts twice a year. The deadline to apply for the next cohort is January 10, 2020. For more information and to apply, visit millionlivesclub.org.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.